You ready for episode two?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so how you doing?
Doing great. Doing
How was your day?
wonderful.
How was your
Even
day?
it was a slow day, but I made it to now, so that's a good thing.
And how was your week? How have you been since our first episode
I've been
recorded?
floating. For some reason this week seems so different. For some reason, I guess I know I've been on Facebook. I've been looking at people's replies. And it's been a lot of attention and a learning curve at the same time. So
Yeah, we have gotten a really good response from people. So thank you, people who are listening.
keep on listening.
How was your weekend?
It was short as always, and I didn't do anything. I just rested and I walked, caught up with some TV, caught up with some internet, YouTube videos, and that's pretty much it.
What'd you watch on TV?
I watched this good show called The Equalizer with Queen Latifah.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's like a drama, and actually it's a remake of an older show that used to be on, I think, CBS, called Equalizer. But
Oh.
I forgot the guy's name that was the star of it, but he had like a British accent. But Queen Latifah does an awesome job. I was just so happy for her. And she's actually an executive producer on the show as well.
I love Queen.
So yeah, everybody loves Queen Latifah. She's just amazing.
So it's related to another TV show. It's not related to the Denzel films.
Well, I haven't seen the Denzel films about the Equalizer, but that may also be the same character. She's not
Got it.
playing the same character, but it's the same format,
Okay.
And I used to watch the Equalizer when I was a kid. My mom used to watch it, and I didn't really pay attention to it. I just knew that he was a good guy, and he just sort of came in and tried to help people, to equalize things. And
Yeah.
so she's doing that now, and she's the perfect character for it because her no, just the sort of character she chooses sometimes is like usually it's always like this fair person. She usually comes in with the sound, the reasoning, and so this is sort of like Murder, She Wrote in a way, but
Oh,
with a edge to it.
got it.
So how was your weekend?
My weekend was good. I did have some fun. Saturday was really cold. I don't think I did anything outside, but on Sunday I went to the Kenilworth Aquatic Gardens near me. And it was really nice. It was just really nice to be outside. The sun was shining. It was a little chilly, but it was, I think it was 32 degrees Fahrenheit, so it felt warmer compared to Saturday, where the wind chill was like 23. But my goal this year is to see the full life cycle of the lotus.
Okay, what's that?
And so at the aquatic gardens, they're known for the lilies and the lotus there. They're like, I think, 19 ponds, and the lotus flower is beautiful in the summer, and I think its full bloom is in August. And last year I had the goal of seeing the full life cycle. So like going at least once a month to see, because it dies every year and it just rebirths every year as well. And then Corona happened and they closed the park from like March until June or August, or right. Actually, I think it was until August. So I was like, this year I'm definitely going at least once a month. In the summertime, I probably go every weekend, but
Okay. I see the signs like when I'm coming to through DC to get to Virginia if I'm in Maryland. I'll see this says the aquatic gardens. I think I'm saying it correctly. So I'll drive past if I've never been. So I'll definitely check it out.
Yeah, we should go one day. It's one of my favorite places in the
Okay, in DC. Oh,
yeah.
cool. Okay. So you ready for these topics? I'm ready. I'm gonna describe.
Yeah, before we
Yay.
get in, just let people know that we're going to try a different format this week. So let us know what you think. We will bring you topics to inform, topics to inspire, and something to make you laugh.
Yeah.
So you ready for the first one?
Yeah, I am. I really like this topic that you submitted. It was different. It's something that I wanted to talk about for a while, but since you brought it up, like, oh yeah, this is the perfect timing.
So why don't you frame it for us?
So, Dr. Carl L. Hart, he is a professor at the he's a professor of behavior neuroscience and psychology at Columbia University in New York. And Hart is known for his research on drug abuse and drug addiction. He even has a book out called Drug Use for Grownups: Chasing Liberty in the Land of Fear. And he is an opponent of the drug war propaganda. So I've been watching some interviews by him, and he's a really, you could tell he's a really intelligent guy. He has a gold tooth right
Does he?
here. He
You can't
does.
tell in his photo.
At first I thought it was a missing tooth, but then I started looking close when I saw the Rogan interview. And he's like, oh, that's a gold tooth. I said, okay, that's interesting. So he has a gold tooth. He's a black guy, dreads. Maybe I think he looked like he's maybe his early 40s, maybe, but really, really smart. And he said he does cocaine almost every day, and he's a better person because of it, you know.
I saw something different. So, I came across the insider.com had an article called A Columbia Professor Who Uses Heroin Says the Drug Helps Him Maintain a Work-Life Balance and Should Be Legal for Everyone. So I found the article on Facebook when Dr. Jason Nichols shared it. And one of the quotes from the article was that Dr. Hart says, "My heroin use is as recreational as my alcohol use. Like vacation, sex, and the arts, heroin is one of the tools that I use to maintain my work-life balance." And so I thought he said that he doesn't use it every day. It's more of a weekly thing. But you said cocaine, so maybe in another place he said he uses cocaine.
Well, he's a proponent of heroin, cocaine. He doesn't have a problem with any of the, from what I was researching, he doesn't have a problem with any of those. Now, I do know he did mention heroin, and that's an important factor. I mean, for him, it's sort of like like you said, like alcohol. He like having a come home from work, and you settle down for the day, and you decide to have a glass of scotch or something instead of he would have, some heroin
Right. He said, like, lines by the fireplace. What's wrong with that? Right.
or from when I also some things that I saw with him, another interview I saw, he mentioned cocaine, so he even went into about the history of cocaine. I mean, I knew that when Coca-Cola first came out, it was actually cocaine was in it.
Absolutely.
And they actually took the cocaine out, not because it was necessarily illegal everywhere. It was taken out because they didn't want black people to have it, because they felt like when they felt like it was it with black people using, if I'm quoting it correctly, it just seemed like it'd be like something was dirty or something that was lower class. So they, so laws, this is prohibition time. So there's a lot of things are going on around the prohibition time. You had segregation, you had Jim Crow, you had all these things going on. And it was very political when they, but he just really felt like this, it wasn't because cocaine had a negative effect on society. It was more so about politics and, I don't want these people to have it. So they took out the cocaine and replaced it with sugar and carbonate. So
Sugar is the new cocaine, if you ask me, allegedly.
it again.
I said sugar is the new cocaine, if you ask me.
Yeah, and caffeine,
Right.
caffeine and sugar together, I think is even more addictive than I've heard is more addictive than cocaine.
Well, I know for
So.
sure studies have shown that sugar is more addictive than morphine in rats, at least.
Well, I believe it because I am addicted.
So what do you think
I'm
about what Dr. Hart is saying and his viewpoint?
so So I'll be honest about me. I don't do drugs or anything like that. But I've been a proponent of ayahuasca, which is a psychedelic. Mm-hmm. And I've been wanting to go on a retreat, an ayahuasca retreat. And it's done very well. A shaman is in charge and they have done this for centuries. You know, I mean, for real. I mean, I think it's been carried down for years. And you can go online and put in ayahuasca. I'm not going to spell it for you because I'm sure I'll misspell it. Look it up. Ayahuasca is 1,000 videos out there about it. You go to Peru and they'll hook you up. But I mean, you have to do your research because it's not just about going to overseas to get high. It's about actually a spiritual work that you're doing. So I do know the power of psychedelics and LSD and all those things. But this is different. It's different because he's actually taking this not as a sacrament, but as, hey, this is how I settle my day. Like I come home from work, I had a busy day. He's a professor. He comes home from work and I guess finished grading papers or whatever, reading, you know, dissertations. And then he has some heroin. And it sounds so crazy to be saying, but if you listen to him speak about it, he really speaks about it in an educated manner. And I think that's great. The only fear I have in it is that there are people out there. I mean, it's like people are addicted to food. They're addicted to, you know, Pepsi, which Coca-Cola. I mean, I love candy bar. So if we have this problem with balance, society, especially in the United States, have a big problem with balance. If you just made heroin and cocaine and all these different narcotics legal for everyone to have, and they say, hey, the candy store is open, how would that affect society? You know, it was an accident just a few days ago on the 23rd with Tiger Woods. His car rolled over. They're saying that it had nothing to do with drugs. But the first question that came to mind when you hear about that car rolling over was Tiger Woods drunk? Was he intoxicated? Was he high? That's the first thing that everybody asked. And they're saying, no, that's not the case. It's just that it's a very difficult road to navigate. And a lot of accidents happen on this particular road. But we do deal with a lot of incidents where people are driving under the influence. And what's the guy named Bruce Springsteen? Just arrested last week for a DWI, just thrown out this morning. So we have a problem with people drinking and driving and still, you know, doing drugs and driving. Will this increase that?
So you agree with him that, mm-hmm. Well, do you agree with him at all? That wasn't clear.
I do agree with him that I think that psychedelics and narcotics can expand our minds and make us more self-aware. Mm-hmm. I do believe that. But the problem with it is that when it's abused, which, you know, it is abused. You know, opiates is crazy right now. I don't think that society, especially American society, can handle making that just, I can walk into the CVS and just say, hey, I need some heroin, and then hand you a prescription and I'll just walk out and head home. I don't think that's, I think that'd be problematic.
Okay. Well, because I mentioned Dr. Jason Nichols, who's a senior lecturer at UMD, my alma mater, in the department that I graduated from, is how I learned about the article. I agree with what he shared along with the article, his opinion, which is that Dr. Hart doesn't really acknowledge his position in terms of his class. Like, he has access to resources so that he can use responsibly. He studied drugs. So like he knows the signs of dependency and how to avoid them. He probably has access to healthcare and a physician to monitor his health.
Right.
You know, so he has a different position than most people. And so that's one thing. That's something that I think we just need to acknowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I also am a proponent that we need to decriminalize a lot of our substances, mm-hmm. Because we need to take the profit away from people filling up prisons, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we do need to address that. However, we also need to address the other broken systems that can lead to us filling up prisons. So like if a Columbia professor needs to take lines of heroin to decompress, think about the people who are working 3 to 4 minimum wage jobs to get by. They probably need something to decompress as well. Or people who are living in concentrated poverty, like where their own existence is a stressor.
Mm-hmm.
They also need, you know, a way to decompress. So if we address those things that would mm-hmm. have people in those positions, perhaps there would be less of a need to escape. That's just a radical idea.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And I also think that we can't even have this conversation. You sort of alluded to it, but we need to go back and take a look at what this war on drugs is. So I did a little bit of digging, and I have a quote that I wanted to read from a Harper's article from 2015, I think. And it is an article that talks about the war on drugs. And this is a quote from someone that worked in Nixon's administration.
Okay.
And this is when that war on drugs began. So the quote is, the Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House had two enemies, the anti-war left and Black people. He said, you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
We mm-hmm. knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war on Black, the war or Black. But by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and Blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. So that is a quote from John Elrickman, and he was the Watergate co-conspirator and Nixon's domestic policy advisor. So clearly we know that the war on drugs is fake. It's made up, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we also know that there is a high potential for chemical dependency.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So what do we do?
Well, you know, I look at countries like, what's the country? I forgot the name in Europe that, you know, there you can't walk down the street and just smoke, you know, marijuana or do cocaine, but there are like bars where you can go into
the Netherlands
cafes. Yeah. And smoke, you know, is legal. Mm-hmm. It depends on where you are. And they don't have a large problem. They don't have a societal problem with addiction. Like we have here. And we have, I mean, food is an addiction. Sugar is addiction. Coffee is an addiction, but they are legal addictions, you know? So I feel like by us saying this thing here is off limits, it actually enhances I can't get this. So let me, it's that thing of if it's forbidden, then I'm going to go out and get this thing because I don't really supposed to have it, you know? On top of that, and he did mention.
I'm not sure that is a thing though. I think people get it because either they've used it and it worked or they're chemically dependent. I don't think that, I could be wrong, but I don't think that the appeal of illegal substances is because they're illegal. The appeal of them is because they're exciting. Like they cause a reaction that people enjoy.
No, I love a cup of coffee. I know the reaction I get when I got out of bed in the morning and ate my first cup of coffee. I'm just saying that I believe in free will. Look, if you're old enough to get it and you really want it, you're going to get it. And Dr. Hart, he did mention, he said that the reason why I think it should be legalized is because he said that the stuff that you get on the street is just crap. He says filled with all kinds of things because it's been cut and cut and cut. He said this, the stuff that he's getting, it is top grade. So he's not going to have all the problems that what you're going to get if it, when it's a street drug. So I can look at that as well, you know, that you're not getting the best product because it's a street drug.
I agree. I agree with that as well.
I just feel like there's a problem because, you know, the reason why we have an opiate issue on an opium epidemic on our hands is because corporations abuse. So even if anytime you have corporations coming in on a profit, it's going to be abused. And they were sued for billions of dollars because they did not explain to doctors fully.
Dependency.
Exactly.
So, it's complicated. When we talk about, I understand, like, it is complicated. And I still think we need to decriminalize because of all the things that you just said, you know, like, there's so many reasons. But the other thing that I want to really bring up and touch upon, which I sort of was alluding to when I brought up the Nixon thing, is that we can't just talk about drugs. We can't just talk about the legality of them and not also talk about racism. And that is why I'm a proponent for decriminalizing, because there's so much racism in this country. Like, it is a foundation of our country.
A founding principle.
It is a founding principle of our country.
Yeah, and it so is.
It's in all of our systems. Decriminalizing will allow us to...
I think decriminalize it actually because there's so much racism in our country that the most of the African-American men that are behind bars,
and women,
unfortunately, and women, are because of small crimes of selling marijuana, cocaine. And by legalizing that, then you stop that basically, you know, modern slavery of, you know, sending, you know, I mean, I'll tell you the story about when a cousin of mine is in prison, you know, and he's been there for over 20 years. And he went in when he was 15 and I'm 42, he's probably 40 or 41. So imagine how much time that is to be locked up. But when a few years after, I think maybe I was probably 19 or 20, I went to go visit him. And when I went to go visit him and I sat in that commissary, and it was almost like I was sitting in high school in the cafeteria. That's how many young African-American men that looked just like me. Mm-hmm. It was literally like I was sitting in the cafeteria of my high school. And I said, I'll never go back because my little impressionable mind doesn't need to make me believe that that's where I belong. Mm-hmm. I don't belong there.
Yeah.
And most of those men that were in there, they were there because of selling marijuana, doing marijuana, selling cocaine. And that's unfortunate because it's just everything that you just explained.
Yeah, it is. And then the other thing is that criminalizing someone for using or selling does not stop the issue. You know, if someone's chemically dependent on a substance, putting them in prison does not solve the issue. It doesn't. And then, you know, it's really insulting. It's insulting that there are so many people still behind bars for marijuana charges when, you know, we've got all these dispensaries that feel like Disney World right now. You know, I just think that there's more cause and more reason to decriminalize, not necessarily legitimize, but decriminalize, because that system of prison profit needs to be broken. And it only contributes to the compound effect of racism, especially in the Black and Brown communities. And when I was thinking about this story, I wanted to share two other things that I looked up. One thing is, why do people misuse drugs? And so while we are also talking about this, and you've talked about the opioid epidemic, and I'm a little hesitant to go along with that language, because it only became an epidemic when white people were being impacted at a greater rate, right? You know, when Black people in the 70s were dying of heroin, it wasn't an epidemic. It was Nixon's world of, you know, just Black people are drug users, you know. SAMHSA had a study in 2017 titled "Why Do Adults Misuse Prescription Drugs?" And they surveyed 11.5 million adults who misuse prescription pain relievers at least once. And their reasons were to relieve physical pain, to relax or relieve tension, to experiment or see what the drug is like, to feel good or get high, to help with sleep, to help with feelings or emotions, to increase or decrease the effects of other drugs, and because the respondent is hooked or has to have the drug, or for some other reason. So those are like the top reasons why people would misuse a prescription drug. Not sure why they would use an illicit drug. However, I know with Percocet and Oxycontin, which are opioids,
there's a song out there called Percocet.
Yes, there is.
we was thinking about it now.
Exactly, right? You know, but the other thing is, a lot of people who were a part of that epidemic started off with prescription drugs and then went to illicit drugs, because an opioid is an opioid. Again, when I hear war on drugs, I just think of war on street drugs, right? The system, healthcare, is also broken. And you know, you mentioned how the pharmaceutical companies were sued because of their lack of transparency. I think maybe one company or someone is serving time for that. I don't remember. I didn't do that research.
Okay. I just heard they was paying several billions out.
Right. But money doesn't bring back a life.
It's a pat on the hand, because right. If you've made, you know, $50 billion off this, and you're only paying $5 billion, that's just a pat on the hand.
Right. So the other thing is, you mentioned Amsterdam and the Netherlands. I was curious, because there's been a lot of talk about decriminalizing substances. You know, DC this year passed the lowering of priority for psychedelics, not all psychedelics, mostly plant medicine is what it's called. So it's still a Schedule I, but it's lower on the priority for MPD to act upon, right?
Okay.
So I was thinking about where in the world are they decriminalized, and why does it work? And so I found this Time article from 2018, says, "Want to win the war on drugs? Portugal might have the answer." So apparently in the 90s, an estimated 1% of the population in Portugal were hooked on heroin. And that includes bankers, students, and socialites. And they had the highest rate of HIV infection in the entire European Union. But in 2001, they were the first country in the world to decriminalize the consumption of all drugs. And then a 2015 study found that since they approved that national strategy, and that led to the decriminalization, the per capita social cost of drug misuse decreased by 18%. So they were able to address it in a way that seems to be working for them. There were several different health outcomes that improved. Of course, like the HIV rate went down, drug use overall, it looks like it went down. But their approach before was to criminalize and put people in prison, and they realized it wasn't working. Now, our country is a little bit different because of all the things that we talked about. Like, we're not just dealing with drugs. We're also dealing with racism. And we've got all of these other things that lead to people even using in the first place. And I feel like, yes, we need to decriminalize. We can't yet get to the place where we legitimize. And Portugal didn't do that either. But unless we also address these other broken systems in our country, anything that we do is going to be incomplete.
I agree 100%. Yeah. About that, I mean, you know, it's just that race is such a big deal in our country that there is no topic that we can discuss that race sort of is a part of it, you know.
Absolutely. So which is important. Why we always need to be talking about racism.
Yeah, you know, it's just not going anywhere anytime soon, because it's all, you know, and we talk about fear a lot, and in this country there's so much fear, and it's like sometimes I see how much fear is out there that people have in this country. Sometimes I go and I you know, talk myself out of it, because I try to be a optimist and just don't throw my hands up in the air and say, oh, these people are never going to get it. We'll always be impacted by racism. These people will always resort to their fears. You know, I try to come off that ledge, you know. So I do waver back and forth with that. And because of just the atrocities that have happened and atrocities to come.
Mm-hmm. So what's the breakdown on Dr. Carlhart?
So I think the breakdown to me on him is he will be somebody that we're going to hear more about. And as we move forward, I think that his position that he has is a controversial one. Also, it's on the, I'm quite sure I'm saying this word wrong, but just on the precipice of just where we're going. You know, we're going to see more drugs that are now illegal begin to become opened up to be more legalized. I wouldn't say it's going to be like I can go and get heroin from the CVS. But I think that it's going to be an easier approach on the criminalization of drugs. And I think that he would be, his name is going to come up, you know, during this process. So I'm interested to see more about him, but it's just difficult, because I feel like there are some underlying issues that we could probably have this conversation for the hour about the underlying issues that come along with making a drug like heroin legalized for everyone to just simply go down to the store, to the CVS, and buy it. I just think that that's a problem. How you feel about that?
Well, I feel my breakdown is Dr. Hart has privilege that needs to be, he needs to acknowledge that. I do agree that we need to decriminalize a lot of these substances, but we should also work just as hard to make this a world where people can exist, where they don't need to escape, or if they do, that it can be like Dr. Hart, where it's like vacation and not a daily use. You know, like, I think it would be amazing if we live in a world where if your jam is to take a line of heroin and not become dependent, that you can do that, but not that you're so stressed and pushed that you need to escape and then you become dependent and then your life depends on not being in the present.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I mean, I watched a documentary just to close this conversation out and to move to the next topic. I watched a documentary on where all the heroin comes from and cocaine comes from. And it comes from Afghanistan. And the documentary literally shows how they make it, and they make it in the boatloads. And they were like, well, why don't you guys sell this? And why don't you just, you know, sit back and do this cocaine? It's pure. It's 100% pure. He said, you don't even get that nowhere near pure once you get it back here to the States. And they said, why would we? We don't need this. You know, most people don't know what it is for. Like, they don't even have a concept of heroin there in Afghanistan. It's useless there. So so nobody's going to buy it there in Afghanistan because it doesn't even make any sense why you would even take it. So even for Dr. Hart, the question is, why would you even take it? Why would you even need that? Why would you even need to take a, have a beer after work, you know, or get up and have coffee in the morning? Why would there even be a need? Or there's something underlining there of dissatisfaction that you need to have something outside of that, that extreme? That what is the underlying issue there for you? So that's the real question that I would propose to want to ask him is, why do you need to come home to decompress and take heroin, even if you're doing it in a way that's non-addictive and non-disruptive to your normal life?
Well, I'm not going to ask him that because that's not my business.
I would like love him to be a guest in our show. I would love that.
Okay.
That would be a question I would ask him.
Okay. Yeah, that's not my business. And like I said, I think it's cool if you want to do it, if it's like vacation, you know, mm-hmm. like if you need to escape for a little bit, however you want to do that, that's great. But when it becomes less of escape and more of a prison, then that is something that I'm concerned about. And why and how you got pushed to that, I think, is what gets to be addressed. All right, let's shift the energy and move on to the next topic. So you got us something funny, huh?
Yeah, I watched SNL, and I love SNL, Saturday Night Live, and I've been watching it for a long time. I used to wake up as a little kid, and I would actually sneak and watch because I probably sleep, and I would watch it because you didn't need cable back then to even watch it. So I would have a little black and white TV. And so Reggae Jean Page, he's a big star. He stars in the hit show on Netflix, Bridgerton. What was so great about his monologue, not was anything he was really saying, it was just that the women's response to him just coming out, it was like all these whoops and hollering, ah! And I'm just like, okay, well, I guess he's the next big thing, because, you know, Patrick Dempsey was really like that for that show, that
Shonda Rhimes.
Shonda Rhimes. But I think they killed him off. So this guy is
really the... spoiler alert. I stopped watching Grey's a long time ago. I was waiting for it to be done so I can binge it all.
Oh, you know, he's still alive.
You didn't even give me a spoiler alert.
Patrick Dempsey is alive and kicking. So he gave his monologue, and it was a lot of whoops and hollering because he's the new McDreamy, and so I want to look up him and see, find more information about him and who he is and where he come from. And he comes from London. He's born in London. He's biracial. I think you can look at him and kind of tell there's some mixing going on there. And his mother is Zimbabwean, and his father is an Englishman. Mother was a nurse, and his father was a preacher. I don't know if they're doing that now, but they are. When I read this information about this, what they were saying about his parents. And he has played Chicken George in the 2016 miniseries Roots. And in 2018, which I think that season, that show, this show called For the People, he starred in on ABC. It was a legal drama, but it ended after two seasons. And that was also Miss Rhimes' show as well. So I guess, you know, he did a good job on that show, even though it didn't last for two seasons. I guess she saw the potential in him and decided to use him as one of the stars in this new show that she has on Netflix, which is her first show on Netflix. And it's really working out for her and for him. So we'll leave a link, I think, in the section under the video to see his monologue.
I did see the monologue, and I thought that there was another sketch that they did that was hilarious, which was the Let's Say Grace. And it was, if you imagine like a rap battle from the 90s or early 2000s, but about praying for over the food. So it's like a white family and a black family battling out over who can say grace the best. And it was hilarious. So yeah, we'll also put that link in there. And we want to hear from our listeners, you know, all 20 of you.
All 20,000 of you.
Okay, speaking into the existence. But yeah, check out both of the links and then find us on social media and let us know what you thought. So you ready to move into our next topic?
Yes. I need to be like, yes, because this is the assassination of Malcolm X. So I don't know why I'm so excited about that, but it is a good news on the other hand about there is some information out there that we have, well, it's been established by his family. You want to start?
Sure, I'll set it up. So his family released a letter that shows that the NYPD and the FBI were involved in his assassination. And so what happened was there's a letter from Raymond Wood, who was an NYPD police officer. He describes from his deathbed that he was involved. He or the police officers were involved in luring two members of Malcolm X security detail into committing crimes that resulted in their arrest 2 days before he was assassinated. So they weren't there managing the door. And so now this has been released. The FBI or the NYPD have no comment, but we do have this letter now.
Yeah, and the FBI is also silent as well. Yeah. So it's very eerie. But I watched a little bit of a documentary on Netflix called "The Who Killed Malcolm X," and when I started watching, I said, "Oh, just an hour, I'll get through this pretty quickly." And then I realized that it was several episodes.
That's right.
So I didn't finish watching it. Okay. But to me, the first episode really set up a really good foundation about what happened, about actually who. It didn't explain who killed him, but it definitely set you up to understand that who you thought killed him may not be the one who actually killed him. So the three gentlemen that were arrested for assassinating him, there's a lot of conspiracy around. Are those the ones who actually assassinated Malcolm X? So Hagen. So this gentleman by the name of Thomas Hagen, he is one of the gentlemen that actually did some of the shooting that day. And he specifically said a few years after he had been in prison that the two other gentlemen that were arrested in conjunction, Norman Butler and Thomas Johnson, were not involved. And no one cared. Those gentlemen stayed in prison for a long time and they were released after, I think, 20 years they were released. And they're now, they both died. And, you know, I don't know how they died, but they never, ever were cleared of those charges. And maybe now this letter will help clear some of that up.
Yeah, what did you think of that, though, about the FBI and NYPD, the allegation of them being involved?
Well, I worked for the Department of Justice for a little while as a consultant, so I can't do a lot of, you know, generally speaking, what I would say is this. The FBI back in this time really saw anyone who spoke out against this country as a target. If you want to make yourself a target, say something negative about the president at that time or the Vietnam War, you made yourself a target. Malcolm X was a target, Martin Luther King Jr. was a target, and they wanted to bring these men down. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't surprise me that the FBI would be investigating him, targeting him. Now, I would not go as far to say the FBI had something to do with killing him. But I would say that of that particular, that moment in time where this country was, you know, still, we are still having a race problem, but really having that civil rights issue at that time, they really saw these two men as problems, and Malcolm X definitely to them was a problem. So
Go ahead. Well, I would go as far to say is that this doesn't feel surprising to me at all that the FBI would be involved in the assassination of Malcolm X, just because of what we said earlier in terms of how racism is founding principle of this country. You just said that any person who spoke out against the country or against the leaders of this country would be a target. So we have two cinematic references of late that lead to this conversation. So Judas and the Black Messiah, which reveals a story of Fred Hampton and his relationship with the Black Panther Party. And the-
I haven't seen that yet. I was going
to
watch it.
Definitely need to see that. But it talks about how the FBI was involved in his death and how, you know, Lakeith Stanfield's character is the one playing the spy. He was used by the FBI to learn about and sort of break down the Black Panther Party. And from my perspective and my understanding what the Black Panther Party was, is so here's the thing. To be Black and to want Black liberation was to go against the United States, because the founding principles of the United States were racism. So that means that people who were looking for Black liberation or the liberation of all oppressed people, like Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X and Huey Newton and Fred Hampton and the Black Panther Party, all of those people were targets just because they were looking for liberation and the end of oppression and equal treatment of people who are oppressed. So to me, it makes sense that the FBI would be involved if the goal of this nation is to uphold racism.
Okay.
Now, you don't have much to say about that because of your work, you know, but to me, it wasn't, I feel like this is obvious. And then the other, I said there was two theatrical references. The other is Regina King's directed One Night in Miami. Mm-hmm. Which is the conversation between, who was in that? It was Muhammad Ali, mm-hmm. Malcolm X, mm-hmm. Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown, all in mm-hmm. one room, right? And in the film, the guy who plays Malcolm X is cautious of his security. Like, he doesn't trust them fully, and he's acting like he's being followed and trailed. Mm. So, like, there was that, you know, and even in his autobiography, he talks about knowing that his life was
coming to an end.
In jeopardy, right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that
it's eerie. It's just, I mean, when I start discussing Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, sometimes there's a part of me that gets so frustrated about that period in time. So, because
in what way?
Frustrated in a way that where I go, thank God I wasn't born in that time. And I was born in 77, but that I wasn't born in the 50s and the 60s, because I would have an issue with anyone telling me, well, this is the level that you can go in society because you are a Black male, or you being a Black woman. That would have been, you know, that wouldn't have been the answer for me.
But DJ, a lot of that hasn't changed.
I agree.
Mean, there has been some changes, but a lot of that is still the same.
I can't compare because I wasn't in the 50s and the 60s. I wasn't born then.
We don't have Jim Crow laws, but we still have structural racism that keeps people of color
I wouldn't argue that at all, that racism still is alive and well, and we are definitely as African Americans affected by racism. but also as an African-American man who is I look at myself as a person who dictates his own vision. And my God doesn't have any color. And that's who I know and I feel that has the upper hand in any situation. So for me to say that there's some other person out there who holds the gate to my success just isn't how I look at life.
I understand that. And I would agree with that too. However, are you also saying that the God that has no color wasn't around in Jim Crow era?
That's true. But, you know, I can't judge that because that wasn't my experience. So I can look at that and say, well, those folks, and thank God for those individuals who stood up and were murdered and maimed and sacrificed their lives. For what divine reason, I couldn't tell you. But thank God they did, so I could have a, but by me saying that nothing has changed, I'm saying those folks who died and who was maimed and was killed, was for nothing. Nothing's changed. They marched down that road and took, you know, hanged, killed, maimed. Churches were terrorists attacked.
And that also happened last year. Like,
right. But by saying that nothing's changed.
Nothing's okay. Changed. I said a lot of those things are still the same. Like a lot of those things still happen.
Not saying they don't happen. I mean, I would be totally, you know, just oblivious if I could not see that, turn the news on, see that things are still happening. Mm-hmm. But I would not say that those individuals who came before me did nothing so that to improve my well-being and my livelihood and the things that I have accumulated because of their struggles.
Right.
That's all I'm saying.
And all I'm saying is that the work of dismantling, so the work of dismantling racism is always being opposed by systems like the FBI and the police department, which is why the argument to defund the police can be had, right? So we need to defund the police, and that.
So argument, do you feel that defunding the police is going to make defunding the police, is that going to allow the police department to go out and hire more educated, well-trained individuals, offer them less money?
I don't think those two conversations go together.
Okay.
Defunding the police is about recognizing that we are society that is not just existing in the legal and criminal system. Like, we are full people and we have full needs. So everything can't be solved by the police. And then it also is about recognizing that the police system in itself is inherently racist. So to continue to throw money at it and expecting different outcomes is ridiculous. So we need to defund, we need to deprioritize how much money and importance we give the police and look at other ways to manage our society. Like, maybe mental health resources need to be have more in their budget. Maybe social services need to have more in their budget. Maybe there's a way to address the problems that get thrown to the police that don't have to be done by the police. So that's all I'm saying. And I think that's what that argument is about. So it's saying that the police system in itself cannot solve all the issues that we are giving the money to do. So we need to look outside of the police system and see how we can fund those things so that police aren't the catch-all, because they aren't trained to be the catch-all and they're inherently racist.
Well, I feel like that 10% is there that definitely puts a cloud over the majority of the police department, police officers. And on top of that, defunding the police means that now you're going to have people there who you're hiring that are less educated, less trained. And then on top of that, to me, if you're going to defund the police, also take away all those, because the police, when you become a police officer, there are certain, you're not considered the average citizen any longer. Your rights are different. You have more access to you have more rights. So I'm just feeling like, well, we want to defund the police because of their, what, you know, things are happening to, you know, in situations where, you know, of course, to turn the news on. Well, okay, defund the police. But I do not want this a-hole over here policing who's getting paid, I don't know, $30,000 a year with the same rights he had when the police officers were making triple that.
I don't understand. So you're saying that if we defund the police, then we're going to have less qualified candidates? How?
Oh, yeah.
Why are you making
like, well, look, well, look at this. Look at our teachers. Okay, so we now, you know, we have taken money out of our schools, along with prayer, and then you expect that people who are well-qualified and well-educated are going to go searching for those jobs? No, they're not. They're going to go out, once you leave college, you got to pay bills and tuition and all those things, I'm going to get a corporate job, okay? So a lot of reason why we have such a problem with our with education is because we have defunded education. You don't get a better education because you pull money out of it.
So wait, it actually gets worse. Think, hold on, that is a totally different argument, because actually the argument of defunding the police and putting the money in education would actually solve that problem. But what you're saying is
you said putting money in education would solve the problem.
Would solve the problem that you just presented.
Okay, so you're saying that is the
you're
opposite.
You're saying that we have low quality education system because we don't have money in it.
Right.
And so you're saying that is going to directly correlate to the police system, that if we take money out of it, No. If a system is broken, you don't continue to throw money at it. You fix it first.
No, you need to fix it.
There is too much money that is invested in policing that needs to be taken out and given to community resources. And therefore there may be less of a need for police. It doesn't mean that we lower the salaries. All of the money for the budget is not going to salary. A lot of salary the money goes to equipment. Deal. It goes to riot gear. It goes to show that the and way that they're going gear. To police. We don't need that.
How many times I just saw footage the other day of police. Yeah. And I wasn't told a little earlier about Daniel Prude, who was that died 7 days after the police arrested him. And the reason why it even was questioned, because one of the officers had footage of them putting a mesh bag over his head, holding him down while he was in handcuffs. And I think it's still crazy, but the only reason the grand jury didn't convict those officers, because they still felt as though that was not enough information to convict those officers with that footage. And the officer wasn't standing right there. He was standing off in the distance, but it was just a little bit of footage that you had to see what was going on, not enough. But I'm just saying, though, that technology is important.
That's not riot gear. What does that have to do with the price of tea in China? Like, whew.
No, I'm...
But so body cams are one thing. Riot gear is a whole other thing.
It's all coming from the same budget. No, there's no budget for.
What I'm saying
is
that if they're spending all of this money on riot gear, that can be spent on supporting the community. So let's talk about Daniel Prude. Why did they call the police?
Because he was having a mental health crisis.
Absolutely. So if there was more of a presence of mental health counseling in the community, perhaps that's who they could have called instead. People who are trained to respond to that
emergency.
So you're
saying by defunding the police, that money now is going to go towards mental health?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. You know, I don't see that, because, you know, I don't know. To me,
I think it's easy to not have faith that would happen, but that's what the argument is based in. The argument is based in the money that's going to a broken system is wasted. And not only is it wasted, but lives are being taken. And it's not solving the problem. We so need to invest in a holistic approach. So you holistic approach.
So you're saying defunding the police is going to systemically fix the policing of our country?
I'm saying that if we defund the police and reinvest in community resources, we will have a system that can holistically manage itself. Everything doesn't have to be policed. The fact that you would even say police ourselves is a problem, I think. I think the framework that everything needs to be policed is based in the belief that as citizens, we are going to break laws.
Well, that's to me, that's a different conversation in my eyes about what you just stated in terms of policing. I mean, I do believe that we don't need policing for every single thing. Now, I don't believe that, but the policing that we do, that is required, that is needed, you know, how is defunding that going to create a systematic issue? This obviously there's a systemic issue within our policing, but defunding it is going to somehow fix that is just not, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that I've been as clear as I know how to be.
Well, I'm not saying, you know, you made it very clear. It's just that, you know, just because you're clear doesn't mean that it's going to be agreed upon.
No, I totally get that. I totally get that, which is why these debates happen and community organizers are doing the work that they do. Right.
But I know there's a lot of anger involved in now because of all the things that are going on with the bad policing that is happening, and people feel like I'm outraged. We need to defund the police, but I just don't feel that is the correct answer in terms of fixing this systemic issue. That's all I'm saying.
Is that your okay? So my last word on this,
okay,
is that I feel like you're framing defunding the police as in taking away their entire budget. And what I think I'm trying to say, and what I think I've been saying, and maybe I haven't said it this clearly, is that if you look at the budget for police departments compared to the budgets for other departments, the skew is completely off. And there needs to be more of a balance. And when there's more of a balance, there's a systemic, a community approach, a holistic approach to managing society where the police department isn't relied upon as heavily to handle everything, especially things that they're not trained to do. And when we get to that place, if we can get to that place, then there's less of an opportunity for the police to be called for something that they're not trained to do, for the police that's inherently racist to be called and to act on that racism so that Black and brown bodies are killed and maimed. So that's my last word.
All right, I'm gonna let it go. Cause
what's your last word? You can have a last word.
No, it'd be me repeating things I already have said. But I understand the place that you are coming from. I totally get that. It's just that when you say holistic, which I believe in holistic, and I believe in all of that. Now, is it realistic with the problems that we have in society and the way our government works? No. I don't believe that. I don't believe that our society is ready for a holistic look at policing and governing communities.
All right. So I found something to inspire.
Yay.
So today is March 1st, when you guys are listening, if you listen to the day that it is aired. And it's the first day of Women History Month. And so I just wanted to give a shout out to Girl Trek, which is the largest public health nonprofit for African-American women and girls in the United States. And I wanted to give a shout out to their Black History Boot Camp because it starts again today. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Girl Trek, and then I'm going to tell you about the Black History Boot Camp. So Girl Trek started in 2010 with the mission of getting 1 million African-American women walking as a first step to inspiring healthy living, families, and communities. And last year, they met that mark of 1 million, even during the pandemic, with the help of their Black History Bootcamp. Have you heard of that?
I did some research when you emailed me about
but before,
it.
Before you hadn't heard
but
of it?
Before, I never heard of it. No.
Okay. So the Black History Boot Camp is a 21-day walking podcast where members can call in at noon Eastern, Monday through Friday of the boot camp to listen to the founders of Girl Trek educate on a historical figure and join so many others while walking. So last year they had three sessions of the boot camp. The Four Mothers was first, where they educated on 21 Black women who were the four mothers and who we are the daughters of. Then they did resistance training, where they educated on 21 most powerful turning points in Black history. And finally, the prayer edition, where they shared the stories of 21 Black women who found ways to inspire and use prayer to resist oppression. So today they're launching round four of the boot camp, and I am so excited.
Wow.
I encourage everyone, not just Black women, but especially Black women, to go to girltrek.org to sign up so you get the emails with the phone number to call in and listen and walk. And if you're not able to join the call live, they also upload the recording as a podcast so you can listen whenever you're able to walk. I really, really enjoyed each earlier boot camp, and I found myself wiser and inspired and so connected. So I also want to give a shout out to Vanessa and Morgan. They're the founders, and they're also my BFFs in my head.
So you've done it before?
I have. I did all three of the boot camps before. And
oh, wow.
If you haven't done them, you are also, you can still stream them on your podcast players. So I was never able to do it at noon. Actually, I think once or twice I was able to call in at noon and walk with them. So mm-hmm. I always did it on my own time, but it's a really good, the walks are about 30 to 45 minutes. So it's very doable.
Okay. And then I saw one video of a Caucasian girl who actually was taking part in this event. And she was saying that they sent her a playlist of all the, like, you know, say Harriet Tubman, what do you think Harriet Tubman would have listened to? Or what do you think Coretta Scott-Skeen would have been listening to?
Yeah, so, yeah, they did that as well. So every day you get an email that has the link to call in. You get information about who they're educating on or what they're educating on, and then a playlist to go along with it.
That sounds exciting. I like that idea. And that people other than African-American are taking part in this to learn about African-American women. I think that's amazing.
Yeah, allies are invited, and we remind them of their place.
Okay, wow. All right.
I mean, the space is for Black women, but allies are invited as allies.
So,
you have any announcements?
Yeah, I have an announcement. So I am having a workshop, an online workshop called The Seven Truths. I'm a spiritual person. I love spirituality. I love how spirituality has built my life and has enhanced my life tremendously. And I always want to help others use spirituality to enhance their lives as well. So I'm having an online course called The Seven Truths, How to Trust the Master Within. And the master within is your instinct, is your intuition. And you wouldn't believe how important tapping into this this resource. So many people don't tap into it at all, or rarely do. So this online course is going to help you to do that. It's going to teach you how to tap into the master within, how to tap into your intuition. And it's going to be March 7th at 1:30. That's Sunday, March 7th at 1:30. You can put in The Seven Truths, How to Trust the Master Within on Eventbrite. And you should, my pretty face should come up.
We'll put the link in the show notes.
We'll put the link there. And the only thing, we're accepting the donations. You can give whatever you feel is appropriate. You know, you can give $1, you can give $100, you know, whatever you feel comfortable giving towards this workshop. And it will be a 3-hour workshop, and we will cover those seven truths, so that you can trust the master within, so that you can start getting in touch with that intuition and trusting it.
I have an announcement.
Yeah.
My Epic Use book sale is still going on.
Okay.
So I don't know if you know this about me, but I love books. I love books. My first field trip in school in kindergarten was to the library. where we got our library cards, and I've been a library card holder ever since.
Wow.
I have always loved the library. I even worked at a bookstore twice. So over the years, I have accumulated a lot of books. And as I want to downsize, I'm selling. I went through and touched every one of my books last year and selected 200 that I was willing to part with.
Wow.
So I'm selling them, and no book is priced more than $20. And I have a wonderful collection, and you can find out more by going to my Instagram at the Courtney Hinton Experience, and that will be linked in the show notes to access the order form. But that's still going on until all books are sold. Well, let's tell the people how they can stay in touch with us. We
Yeah.
are on Facebook, as DJ mentioned last week, at
Yeah.
Breaking It Down Podcast, and we're on Instagram at Breaking It Down Show. And YouTube. So if you want to see us, you can just search Breaking It Down with DJ and Courtney on YouTube to see us. And we want to hear from you. So go to one of our social media pages and leave us a comment. Let us know what you thought of the show or what you want us to break down in the future.
Definitely. And if you want to email us, it's of course it's breakingitdownshow@gmail.com. Again, it's breakingitdownshow@gmail.com.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening.
Yeah, and catch us next week.